Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Lopez. Lieutenant Commander Pope, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant? And Lieutenant Hamersky, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Thad Pope, and I represent the appellant, MK3 Eliud Lopez. Chief Judge Olson, may I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
Thank you. The appellant was confined illegally for 26 days after the convening authority granted clemency and ordered his release. In our efforts to understand why, the government refused to disclose relevant information absent a court order. Even after filing multiple motions for appellate discovery, the lower court kept the appellant from seeing the relevant known evidence and information that would have shed light on that question. The lower court even said there is simply no evidence of anything other than negligence by trial counsel, even though the court had not reviewed the evidence requested. This invalid reasoning fails de novo review, is an abuse of discretion, and this court should vacate the lower court's opinion. Adding insult to injury, the lower court awarded monetary relief that was not meaningful because the appellant was kept on active duty past the end of his enlistment for the purposes of trial. He was not entitled to back pay. Looking to the standard of review, this court should apply de novo review because the lower court's denial of discovery under Campbell is a legal test that this court created. Campbell already requires a heightened legal standard beyond that which is required for discovery at the trial level. The burden of proof at trial falls on the government to prove his case beyond a reasonable doubt, and the standard for discovery at the trial level, as you know, is evidence relevant to the defense preparation. On appeal, however, the appellant carries the burden to establish his claims to the appellate courts, and in so doing, he at times needs that appellate discovery mechanism to help him establish his claims and make an argument for what meaningful relief should be in the given case. Turning to Issue 2, the lower court erred when it mostly denied appellant's motions for appellate discovery under United States v. Campbell. The lower court denied appellant's additional discovery and focused its analysis on Factor 4 of Campbell, essentially ignoring Factors 1 through 3. And in so doing, the lower court said the appellant fails to show a reasonable probability that the results of this proceeding would be different if the putative information was disclosed. That's Factor 4. And they said there's simply no evidence of anything other than negligence. There's not a scintilla of evidence of anything beyond negligence and failing to notify the brig. But how can the CCA, the lower court, say that there was no evidence of anything beyond negligence after the court willingly blinded itself, refused to grant additional discovery of the known relevant evidence in this case?
Counsel, can I ask you about your two motions, the first motion for discovery and the second motion for discovery? Both of those are pretty bare bones. And in terms of relevance, they largely say we need to look at these documents so that we can formulate assignments of error. And they don't, you know, obviously you haven't seen the documents, so you don't know what your assignments of error are, but they are really just, we need to look at documents to see if there are any issues. And is that enough to cross the Campbell threshold? I mean, maybe Campbell's not the right standard. I mean, maybe it's too high a standard. But just looking at your motions that were filed, they largely just say, both for relevance and prejudice, we need to look at the documents to see if there are any issues or to see if there's any prejudice. And if that's enough, it would seem that there is no threshold, that you could always get appellate discovery.
So, Your Honor, I acknowledge that the standard under Campbell is high. I agree with that. And there are times when the appellant's motions for discovery were framed somewhat broadly by my predecessor, appellant defense counsel. However, if, as you go through those motions, there are specific items that he requested, and that's what we're taking issue with here today, is some of those specific items. Quite specifically, the appellant is seeking discovery of the emails that the Deputy Staff Judge Advocate referenced to appellant's former appellate defendant in her declaration at the Joint Appendix at 33. So we're looking for emails from the Deputy Staff Judge Advocate that were responsive to the IG complaint, and we're looking for the IG complaint itself, as well as the statements that were provided to the DJAG in furtherance of his summation of the incident. So as you go through those motions, Your Honor, I do think that they're specific with respect to those items.
They're very specific about what you're looking for, but then in the sections where you address the Campbell factors in addressing relevance, it largely just says we need to look at them to see if so that we can help, so we can formulate our assignments of error. And for prejudice, we need to look at them so we can see if there was any prejudice. Is that enough?
Well, what's enough, Your Honor, is the fact that in those motions, the appellant also stated that we asserted assignments of error for prosecutorial misconduct and for UCI. And so it wasn't purely the general term that you mentioned, that we actually argued that we have claimed prosecutorial misconduct for appellant's illegal confinement of 26 days. We have claimed UCI for the cover-up that we think happened after that, and we have known evidence that speaks to those things that we were prevented from getting. So we were specific with respect to those items, Your Honor, if I can respectfully push back on that. And so if I just think it's an abuse of discretion to say we're not going to grant you discovery because there's not enough evidence to justify why you should get the discovery. I mean, it's a cyclical argument here. So I want to look briefly at
Counsel, in the typical case where we see a discovery is trial defense counsel didn't raise a motion, and then we seek discovery asking why didn't you raise that motion, and you know it seems like it's more formulated. It's more focused on, you know, a particular issue where we're going to get a particular answer to a specific question. This looks more like was suggested by the government, a fishing trip where, hey, we want to look at the documents and see if we can find any unlawful command influence or any intentional misconduct.
So, Your Honor, what we're looking for is we're trying to peel back the layers on the culpability of the government with respect to how the appellant ended up illegally in confinement for 26 days. So we're very specifically looking for the degree of culpability, and the reason for that is we need to be able to, the appellant has a due process right to be able to make a fair argument for what relief should follow from his illegal confinement for the due process.
If you were operating in a vacuum, your argument would be perfectly understandable. But we now hear from the facts of this case that the trial counsel twice notified defense counsel about the commanding authority's action here. To say that there's evidence of malfeasance as compared to misfeasance on the part of the trial counsel is a real stretch in light of that fact. How do you surmount that?
Yes, Your Honor. So I do think that that's one aspect of the evidence that speaks to the government's culpability in this case. That's something that the lower court considered when considering the government's culpability and the egregiousness of their conduct or lack thereof. The other evidence that's relevant to that question is the discovery that we requested, that we know exists, that the government told us exists, that we were denied that discovery of. So it's the court, again, the lower court put its blinders on. They did consider some relevant evidence, but they didn't consider all of the known relevant evidence that would have spoken to that. And I think it's crucial to look at former appellate defense counsel's declaration that outlines her conversation with the deputy staff judge advocate in this case, because that's the place that will answer, I think, your question, Chief Judge, about this, because I spoke to the deputy staff judge advocate, and she said that she emailed supervisory trial counsel and another trial counsel and requested a time to talk about, quote, why MK3 Lopez had not been released in accordance with the community authority's action. During the ensuing conversation, the deputy staff judge advocate, and I'm paraphrasing this declaration, expressed that she was not satisfied that the supervisory trial counsel understood the gravity of the situation and that she therefore contacted his boss, the military justice division officer. Now, in that conversation, the deputy staff judge advocate explained to the military justice division officer that they discussed what to do about the situation regarding his illegal confinement, and that she, the deputy staff judge advocate, and the military justice division officer, quote, agreed not to gather or hand over any files pertaining to this issue to the defense, but they would cooperate if asked for information about it in the future, which they subsequently denied. So we have an email exchange where the deputy staff judge advocate says, hey, you know, what happened here? She doesn't get a good vibe from the supervisory trial counsel that's responsible for overseeing this proceeding and the training of the trial counsel potentially at fault here. And she doesn't get a good vibe from him. She calls his boss, and then lo and behold, they agreed not to disclose any information. So she also, after that, she told that after her phone conversation with the Military Justice Division officer, she was copied on an email from the Military Justice Division officer. And this
before your time expires, I'd like to move on to the issue of monetary relief.
Yes, Your Honor.
Presumably you've had an opportunity to read our opinion in Valentin Andino.
I did, Your Honor.
In your view, how does that decision affect this case?
So in my opinion, my read of that, Your Honor, is that in Valentin Andino, this Court was distinguishing between the terms meaningful relief and appropriate relief under Article 66. And that case was a post-trial delay case. This is a case involving illegal post-trial confinement. So, yes, both post-trial issues, but we're talking illegal confinement versus delay. And when we're talking about illegal confinement, the relief to which the appellant is entitled is meaningful relief under United States versus Suzuki, this Court's predecessor case, and the progeny from it that has flowed from Suzuki. So there are times when the interests of justice require additional discovery and meaningful relief. And this is one of those cases, Your Honor, where the appellant is entitled to meaningful relief, not merely appropriate relief under Article 66. And because we're in that Suzuki sort of box, if you will, and we're in the illegal confinement box, it's basically a step beyond Valentin Andino. That doesn't disturb – what we're asking for wouldn't disturb the Court's ruling in that case.
So when the CCA said, and I'm quoting them, we conclude that setting aside the BCD would be disproportionate, is it your intent then, if you were to prevail in this Court, to go back down to the CCA and argue that the only way there could be meaningful relief would be through setting aside the BCD?
That's our hope, Your Honor. Yes, absolutely. The appellant should have been afforded the opportunity to make a full-throated argument as to why his BCD should be set aside, with the Court using all of the known relevant evidence that existed that we asked them to consider that they refused to consider. So, yes, Your Honor, we ask the Court to vacate the lower court's opinion to order the discovery that we've requested, the specific items that we've requested, plus anything else that the Court deems appropriate, and order additional fact-finding as the Court deems appropriate so that we can make that those additional arguments as to assignments of error and appropriate sentence.
Now, could Monet, please, Judge Maddox.
This is outside the record, and if you're not prepared to answer, but I take it there's probably no civil remedy that's available for your client because of the Ferris Doctrine or some other doctrine. In other words, it's here or nothing. Is that your understanding? Or
I'm not sure whether our client would succeed on a claim before the Court of Federal Claims or something along those lines. Our argument is certainly that the relief that the lower court provided was not meaningful because the monetary credit was ultra vires. They didn't have the authority to award it. I'm not sure how that would equate on the civilian side, though, Your Honor, or civil side, Your Honor.
Now, with the remedy, your client wasn't prejudiced by getting the ultra vires award of back pay. You're just saying that they still didn't get meaningful relief.
That's correct, Your Honor. So we're saying that in lieu of meaningful relief, the lower court awarded relief that was essentially unlawful. They didn't have the authority to award that relief, and so instead of meaningful relief, you got basically nothing.
Are you asking us to strike that relief?
We're asking you to remand the case back to the lower court for sentence reassessment in light of the additional discovery that we're also requesting, and in light of our view that form of relief is unlawful and wouldn't be meaningful.
Counsel, how would you characterize appellant's status during the 26 days that he was incarcerated, the extra 26 days he was incarcerated? Was he still in the Coast Guard at that point?
He was beyond the term of his enlistment, and I think he would be in an appellate leave status at that point, Your Honor.
So I guess was he a member of the military of the Land and Naval Forces at that point?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but your position is that if Article 75 doesn't apply, why?
Article 75 doesn't apply because the appellant didn't have a property interest in pay for the time after the conclusion of his court-martial because he wasn't entitled to pay during those 26 days. As soon as the trial concluded under Coast Guard regulations, he was no longer entitled to pay because he was off – his term of enlistment had ended. So because his enlistment was over, he wasn't entitled to pay while he was in confinement. So whether you're talking about setting aside forfeitures, which are inapplicable here, or awarding back pay, he just simply wasn't entitled to pay during that time. So there's no property to return to him.
So he's still in the Coast Guard, but he's not supposed to be incarcerated during this time. So, but he's not entitled to any pay during this time, even though they haven't let him leave. He's not supposed to be incarcerated, so he's sitting around, but he's not entitled to any pay. Is that your understanding of what his status was at that time?
Yes, Your Honor. And seeing I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Please let me first check. Any further questions?
Just one, please. Regarding this time when he's not due pay, just so I fully understand, Lieutenant Commander Pope, if he had been released in December when he was supposed to, according to the convening authority's action, he would have immediately gone on appellate leave, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So is your position that that's why he's not due any pay, because during the period of confinement he's not due any pay, and even had he been released on time, he would have gone on appellate leave and therefore would not have been due any pay for the remainder of those 26 days, and that's why the relief is not meaningful?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
Further questions?
Yes, I did, Chief.
Judge Johnson?
This is going back to the fact that the CCA did award pay and allowances. And the CCA looked at multiple sister CCA opinions to conclude that they had the authority to do that. And so is it your position that what you would want this court to say is to overrule essentially all those previous CCA opinions that awarded pay and allowances when the service member was beyond his ETS or service dates?
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe Hammond and Sherman were essentially incorrectly decided and misapplied Rosendahl credit. Yes, we think that those cases should be overruled insofar as they found monetary credit that the court didn't have the authority to award.
Thank you, Lieutenant Commander Pope.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Hamersky.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Christopher Hammersky, and together with Lieutenant Liz Eulin, we represent the United States. This court should affirm the lower court's decision today for two reasons. First, when it credited evidence such as the multiple notifications from trial counsel to defense counsel as to clemency, it did not abuse its discretion when it found no reasonable probability that further discovery would unearth evidence that this was anything beyond negligence. Second,
counsel, could you slow down just a little bit, because we get a reverb up here.
Apologies, Your Honor.
No, that's okay. You wouldn't hear it from this side, so.
Shall I repeat it?
No, I heard you. But yeah.
And second, the lower court's remedy, the lower court did not abuse its discretion when ordering a monetary credit pursuant to Article 66 Delta 2 and case law precedent from the Air Force and the Army. On the first issue, Your Honor, we look at how flexible the exact language of the Campbell two-step test is. Specifically, the first step is inquiring whether or not there is a need or whether the circumstances warrant further inquiry. And in looking at this issue, this Court's opinion in Campbell said specifically the lower courts should consider four factors among others. So it's not a shall, it's not a must, and it also provides a open fifth option to consider any other particulars of a case that they think should factor into the analysis. So the first step is geared toward a flexible approach. The second step of Campbell is if inquiry is required or warranted, then this court in Campbell expressly indicated that the CCAs have discretion in determining what form the appellate discovery shall take. Here, the court did not abuse its discretion because it looked at each of the three motions in very different contexts and appropriately decided within the reasonable range of options arising from the facts and circumstances what it thought to be fair. Here, looking at the first motion, appellant, he had the certified record of trial and he had a brig report saying he was let out of the brig a month late. He understandably wants more. As the government, we thought that the prejudice was clear, but at the same time, reasonable minds could disagree. So he submits his first motion for appellate discovery, and as Judge Maggs pointed out, there wasn't a lot to it. It largely said we need to look at more so we can determine what assignments of error we can formulate and support. We didn't think it was necessary. We thought everything that was needed was in the record, but the lower court reasonably looked at everything and said, you know what, although you're asking for all the emails, notes, evidence, statements, everything from 18-plus people, plus everyone in the brig, plus everyone in the CJIS office, let's discover something. Let's tailor this around the one concrete piece of evidence we know exists, the OIG complaint, which had a very specific serial number. And the court said, In your motion, you are specifically looking for why did this happen. Let's find out why this happened. So they said you can have all of the statements and evidence that came out as a result of the OIG complaint from Coast Guard and Navy personnel, and they tailored it. We took the subsequent order. We forwarded the language to the respective offices, asked for any responsive documents, and out came DJAG's email, reciting the history of the case and determining that it was the result of a misunderstanding of responsibility, as well as the CJIS case tracker, which indicated that, as explained later in a sworn statement by that this was all according to procedure, but ultimately they had looked at the OIG complaint, found no reason to suspect criminality, and independently made a conclusion that this was not a crime. Appellant now had the reasoning for why his imprisonment had gone on past the approved sentence. However, several weeks later, he submits a second motion for appellate discovery, this following a request, an informal request to the government saying, please respond, we don't believe that you complied with the spirit of the previous order. Within 24 hours, please give us the following documents, narrowing it down to the OIG complaint, a set of email threads, previously described in Lee's declaration, as well as any other materials resulting from the OIG complaint. We oppose it again, and the lower court was within its discretion to say at the same time, well, as Judge Maggs also pointed out, this is still bare bones. You're not really providing anything new for us to look at. Specifically, in their motion, they say that the OIG complaint was a relevant statement from a incident witness and is therefore discoverable. The email threads were the, quote, source material for DJAG's determination and therefore are relevant, and surmised that there should be additional materials arising from the OIG complaint based on a citation to the 2003 Memorandum of Understanding between the Coast Guard and DHS OIG. However, at no point did he articulate why the OIG complaint, which, according to discussed, a chronology of the clemency, which everyone already knew, as well as a acknowledgement that he had been left in the brig too long, which would simply be cumulative, why the source documents for DJAG's eventual determination would seemingly conflict and provide anything new, and finally, that the 2003 MOU had actually been modified by the 2004 DHS directive, as explained in our brief to the CCA, which essentially reduced the amount of reporting requirements to CGIS, from CGIS to DHS. So with this in mind, it reasonably found no need for further discovery. There was nothing to suggest that DJAG's email was incorrect or anything to suggest malfeasance or anything beyond negligence from trial counsel.
So you say the proper standard of review is abuse of discretion?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Why?
Discovery is messy, Your Honor. Discovery can be messy. The amount of considerations that go in, whether or not things are tailored, whether or not it's a fishing expedition. The Supreme Court in Cuomo v. Clearinghouse specifically articulated that, from 2009, specifically indicated that judges are trusted to prevent fishing expeditions. There's a reason why, in almost any context, discovery is reviewed for abuse of discretion. They have the proverbial feel of the case. They can look at everything. They can see how requests and demands and productions are proceeding.
Now, appellant's point is that this court has, and I believe the phrase they use is the same vantage point as below. Why are they mistaken on that point?
In the sense that, Your Honor, here it's being presented as a singular question that rather than look at what happened across several months, this court is being asked to look at it in one go in terms of did he at any point ever look at what was coming in, whereas we would point out that the context with which the lower court was looking at all this changed from July to August to September through to May as the entire case proceeded. As the court was able to consider these different matters, as new evidence came in, as judicial notice was provided to bring in additional documents, the court could weigh all of these and from there determine, is anything further really necessary?
Why does that differ from our perspective of being able to see the material that was presented and everything that the lower court did?
Well, in part, Your Honor, because this court has explicitly gone ahead and entrusted the process to the CCAs, and with that trust should come deference. In United States v. Lewis, the chief judge, in his concurrence, indicated that the decision of when to order to obey and later any additional appellate discovery, it is entrusted to this court, is entrusted to the CCAs, subject to review by this court. And if a matter is entrusted to someone, it would make sense to offer them at least some deference, which is why de novo is undoubtedly inappropriate. But at the same time, even under abuse of discretion, this court would have the ability under the fifth factor of Campbell that, among other things, if it sees inequity or some consideration that it thinks the lower court didn't consider but should have, it can reach down and say no reasonable judge would have ignored this particular consideration. And reasonable judges can defer, like what happened in Bess, where this court split after looking at the same fact scenario and said some inquiry might have been warranted, and the other wing said no, this was fine, as is. So some deference is appropriate, and that's why abuse of discretion, like any other area of discovery for judges, Your Honor, should be the standard.
Counsel, appellant argues, and this is with regards to abuse of discretion, because part of that string is always, you know, an error in applying the law, findings of facts. An appellant argues that the lower court erred in ignoring the first three factors of Campbell, focusing solely on the fourth factor, reasonable probability. How would you address that? Was that, in fact, error on the part of the CCA?
No, Your Honor. We would believe that that's actually that actually goes to the need for discretion in managing discovery to be afforded to the CCAs. To make an analogy, Your Honor, we cited in our brief to United States v. Fulcher from the Fourth Circuit, among others, and we'd also point the Court to Rule 1210 in the RCMs as to what goes into a petition for new trial, because the factors there fairly neatly mirror the factors that go into Campbell 3, 4, and 5, because they're all very important considerations that go into post-conviction handling of facts or evidence. Specifically, and if any of them are answered in the negative, it would cause one to question why it's being dealt with at this time. So specifically, Campbell Factor 2, was it discoverable previously with due diligence, is mirrored in Fulcher and RCM 1210, because if you could get it previously, why are we making a deal about it now? Factor 3, relevance, is a fairly low bar, but at the same time, if it's not going to factor into this materially, it's not going to really change the outcome. And then, critically, factor 4, we posit, is in fact the most important. It's not do all, die all, but it truly is. If it's not going to change anything, if there's no reasonable probability of it changing, why would we be going through with it? So, and in Fulcher, the Fourth Circuit articulated very clearly that although we review the analysis of these five factors for abuse of discretion, they have never affirmed a case where there hadn't been all five met. They did leave some room to say there could be some extraordinary case where maybe they're not all met, but we would argue that is actually why Campbell is the superior test, because it affords that additional consideration for if this court truly thinks the lower decision was unreasonable to review it. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
I'd like to turn your attention to the issue of the monetary relief.
Yes, Your Honor.
You argue that the CCA had the discretion to provide appellant with monetary credit.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that under 66D2, when it refers to the fact that the CCA had the authority to provide appropriate relief, that the CCA is authorized to engage in equitable relief?
We wouldn't call it equitable, Your Honor, but under
what would you call it?
Appropriate, and where able.
So how do they determine what is appropriate? This is not tied in this case to the pay and allowances because he was not entitled to pay and allowances. So let's say that the CCA were to say, we're going to give you pay and allowances plus $100. Would they be able to do that?
We think that would stray from past precedent, and it would go beyond what past courts have found to be appropriate.
So what if they were to say pay and allowances minus $100? Could they do that?
Again, that would stray from what prior courts, the Air Force and the Army, have said to be appropriate. So,
so when it says appropriate relief, a CCA can only determine that based on prior precedent? And what if we're in a CCA is confronted with a brand new situation and trying to determine what is appropriate relief? There is no precedent.
When there's a circumstance such as that with no precedent and the court tries to, I think as the Army and the Air Force said, trying to fashion a meaningful or in this case appropriate relief, anything new or novel would absolutely be then subject to de novo review by this court. As to whether or not it truly is appropriate, just like this court will review de novo whether or not a monetary credit is within its purview. But where Congress has specifically said that in this specific situation where an RCM or anything under Article 60 Charlie, if any of the post-trial processing is an error or delayed excessively, courts, CCAs, or creatures of statute, you can enter appropriate relief. So we'll turn.
So how does Article 75 fit into this?
Article 75, Your Honor, we believe the lower court citation to it comes from Hammond, where the lower court did not have the current 66 Delta 2 at the time, but in Hammond, the Government Appellate Council went ahead and articulated the proposed remedy of court, CCA, if you think that financial remuneration is the appropriate remedy, if you disapprove certain parts of the confinement, I believe the exact quote in the brief was, there's no reason to believe that the Defense Financial Accounting Service wouldn't respect or wouldn't honor that decision to then make sure that he was paid for that time in jail. So the Army did take a small leap of faith from Sherman, which in turn took its lead from Gazarian in this court. But
so why shouldn't the word appropriate encompass the idea that it must be consistent with UCMJ? And Article 75 is referring to a situation when it comes down to all rights, privileges, and property. And appellant was not entitled to any property because he was not entitled to pay. So why doesn't the word appropriate mean it has to be consistent with the other provisions of the UCMJ?
As a general matter, it should, Your Honor. And we would argue that where CCAs are already in some way in the position to return money to the to appellants or litigants in the context of returning forfeitures by disapproving them, this isn't some completely novel remedy wherein we're saying, well, you were left in the brig too long, here's the deed to the convening authority's house. This is a very discrete matter, very mathematical and tied to precedent. This was all originating out of the 305K pretrial equivalencies, and it did take a few steps to get here, but where Congress has since offered enabling language, where the plain language is clearly broad, if we can tie it back to something from the past where some prior court, and in this case two, both the Air Force and the Army, found to be explicitly appropriate relief, we are comfortable standing here and saying, like, we're going to try for this, because as the lower court
said, we're going to what?
We're comfortable standing up here and trying to articulate this, because the alternative was down below, the case law was clear. Disapproval of punitive discharges in the wake of excess confinement is clearly disfavored. The overwhelming number of cases clearly did not follow that. So where the options articulated by the defense was, you have to disapprove my BCD. It is the only meaningful relief you can give me, or you can give me nothing, so you have to give me the BCD. The court went ahead and acknowledged, if the options were these two, we would give you nothing. And this mistake, Your Honor, this case is the result of trial counsel's inaction. It falls on the government. So where defense goes ahead and proffers those two options to the court, no one feels great about going up to him and saying, like, the case law says you're not going to get suggests strongly you're not going to get your preferred relief. So let's try and find you something in the middle.
So doesn't what you just said cause concerns? No one's going to feel great having to say this to them, is the phrase you just used. Doesn't that indicate that we're in the field of equity here rather than law?
There are considerations that mirror equity, Your Honor, in terms of what is fair, what is just, going back to Suzuki, which says that you should take into consideration certain factors like this. It at times appropriate relief might feel like equity, but where this particular remedy is based in law, in the sense that we were relying on 305K equivalencies to establish a clear rate to credit individuals with, it's sufficiently based in the MCM and past case law that, no, it's not equity. We're not going ahead and awarding distinct monetary awards. It's clearly based in you would have been paid X. We're going to make sure that you were awarded the same amount. So it's the math.
But he would not have been paid X.
Thank you, Your Honor. Where it's based in very predictable math, that takes it away from the field of equity, where every single case is completely different. You have to weigh negotiating power. You have to weigh whether or not contracts are unconscionable. There's It approaches equity, Your Honor, but it isn't equity.
Counsel, can I ask this question? Do we know, is there any way of knowing when such a remedy is awarded, whether the accused actually gets the money?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat that?
Does DFAS actually give the person the money when they're awarded money in a case like this?
So, Your Honor, we're unfamiliar with DFAS in particular because within the Coast Guard, the Personnel and Pay Center is within the Coast Guard. It's not a separate federal agency sitting above it within the DOD. So we actually recognize this case is particularly unique given it's Coast Guard versus Army, Navy, Marine, and Air Force. But here, one of the reasons why the court was convinced – I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time.
Please proceed.
Thank you. One of the reasons the court was persuaded here was they specifically credited – we went to our pay and personnel center and said, here's Hammond, here's Sherman, and here's what happened. Can we make this work? And the chief counsel of the PPC went ahead and indicated that if this is ordered, we will effectuate. So the lower court had confidence and strong reason to believe that if it ordered it, it would go through, which we would posit is one consideration when determining whether or not something is appropriate relief. Does the court have confidence that it will be executed?
Counsel, can I counsel, I want to ask you Judge Sparks' excellent question from earlier. If the appellant had been released after 2 months the way he was supposed to be, what would his status have been after that?
He would be on appellate leave, Your Honor.
And what are his options while he's on appellate leave? Can he get a job? Can he what would have been different? How would his life have been different for those 26 days? Can he leave? Can he what are his options at the moment?
His ability to leave, Your Honor, we believe would be restricted up until the appeals process is not extinguished. Until the appeals process has run all the way through, because where he was adjudged a BCD, until he either withdraws from appellate review or there's a final judgment, the BCD would be in effect. He doesn't have his DD-214, but employment is still possible in any job that doesn't require it, as far as we know. In terms of pay, once he entered appellate leave, he wasn't entitled to pay. But, does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I mean, I think so. I'm just, it sounds like his options weren't great. As long as he wants to pursue his appeal, he can't get out. He can't get paid by the Coast Guard, but you think maybe he could get, maybe there might be other employment that he could have pursued. Is that?
The employment is possible with anything that doesn't necessarily require a DD-214. To the extent that he's bound by this, if he wanted to move on, he could withdraw from appellate review, or we're moving up. As soon as we're done with the review and it's finalized, the BCD could then be effectuated, and then we would move on. So it's...
I have just one question. What authority, if you know, was the counsel for the pay section relying on?
So,
because I think what the Chief Judge and I, at least, seem to be struggling with is that it seems like a remedy is designed to make one whole. And this awarding of back pay to someone who was not entitled to pay, which you can see, does not seem to make someone whole. That gives them more than what they had before. So what authority are they relying on? If you know, you may not know, and I understand.
To the extent I do know, Your Honor, I would offer two parts, if I may. One, the CCA, in its opinion, articulated that there's precedent for declaring a part of confinement illegal, and where past courts have indicated that it's to be in jail illegally during a time you weren't supposed to be through the 305K equivalencies.
But 305 is a... Yes. Pertains to pretrial confinement, which is different than post-trial confinement.
Yes, and that's where the jump from Sherman to Hammond happened. But the sense of here's where the general fixed rate comes from, that's where they generally articulate that one day in jail improperly is roughly equivalent to this amount of pay and allowance. Where we take that and gave it to the Pay and Personnel Center with Sherman and Hammond, he could then look at the Military Justice Manual from which the provision says that once you have been extended for purposes of the court-martial, you are no longer entitled to pay, recognizing that that does not account for instances like where someone is illegally in jail too long. Separately, the Pay and Personnel Center could also refer to the separations manual and at least one other one. But to the extent I can guide the court to a possible answer, the footnote, I believe it was footnote 10 or one of the last ones from United States v. Hammond, wherein ACCA went ahead and said to the extent that help is needed to effectuate this remedy, we would direct the Army to look at this particular statute, it's eluding me, but where someone misses time in service due to confinement in some way, they can be brought up back onto active duty. So where Hammond, Sherman, and the Council's familiarity with all of the pay, all of the separations, and all of the personnel manuals was within his grasp, he was able to determine that if ordered, we can effectuate this.
Hmm. Okay.
Further questions? Seeing none?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you want to briefly conclude? Briefly?
Very briefly, Your Honor. Your Honors, for all the discussed reasons, this Court should affirm the lower court by finding that the lower court did not abuse its discretion, by finding appellant did not demonstrate further appellate inquiry was warranted, and that its grant of a monetary credit pursuant to case law and the plain language of 66 Delta 2 was not error. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Hammersey. Lieutenant Commander Pope.
This Court should not allow the lower court to bulletproof their denial of discovery by saying that there was no evidence and that we effectively won't change our minds about sentence relief anyway. The lower court and the government, to some degree, blended the discovery standards under Campbell Factor 4 with the prospective remedy in this case, blending the error and the remedy. But the lower court saying that, you know, they basically wouldn't find a setting aside the BCD to be appropriate in this case, what am I trying to say here? The lower court limited the scope of its review to the evidence that it wanted to see, not to the evidence that was in the record, plus the additional relevant known evidence.
Lieutenant Commander Pope, on that point, is your problem basically that you and your client don't accept the statement from the Deputy JAG? In other words, his having looked at the information, filing his affidavit or statement, that there was no malfeasance here, this was all negligence. You just don't accept that? Is that the problem here?
Well, essentially, yes, Your Honor. I mean, it's a trust but verify. We have the
Well, why would you not trust that? Is there something else that convinces you that there is this nefarious motive afoot?
Apart from the sheer lack of any percipient witness statements, any direct evidence, any IG investigation report, apart from the absence of those things, and I probably read a little bit too long initially, but I would direct the Court's attention back to it, in which discusses the Deputy Staff Strategy Advocate's statements to the defense. And there's two things I want to highlight from that. The Deputy Staff Strategy Advocate said that the email contained a string of emails on which the DJAG and the CJIS special agent in charge of the IG complaint were copied. So we have this string of emails with the relevant parties, including the IG investigator on behalf of the IG, and it's directly regarding the clemency action taken in MK3 Lopez's case and the reasons why he wasn't released from confinement.
No, I understand that, but you've mentioned this. You need to verify the Deputy Judge Advocate General's statement. I mean, they do not get the presumption of regularity at all?
So the DJAG told the IG investigator to close the complaint. Those are his words. Close this complaint. Recommend that you close this complaint. He is the number two attorney in the Coast Guard. He's the person responsible for managing and overseeing the trial counsel at issue in this case. He's the one responsible for, you know, from a leadership standpoint, for their.
But that sounds like you want something, someone to do something about, something to this particular lawyer who had this doubt of negligence. But that's, isn't that beyond what you need to know in your pursuit of a remedy in this case?
I think it might be relevant to a degree, Your Honor, but what we're really saying is what we need to know why this happened so that we can make an argument, a fair argument, have a chance to make a fair argument as to the degree of culpability of the government and the degree of the egregiousness of their conduct, which is the standard under Suzuki. We can't make a full-throated argument.
Is that really a fair summary of Suzuki? I don't mean to do this in your rebuttal, but like Suzuki just sort of mentions, here the facts were egregious, so we're going to give some additional relief. It doesn't really say that relief in all cases is dependent on the level of negligence or malfeasance in a particular case.
I agree, Your Honor, in the sense that it says, in the interest of justice, the Suzuki court held what it held. And in this case, we have some red flags that we've not been allowed to.
Are there really any red flags, or is it like, what do you point to say that there's evidence that there's a suggestion of egregious facts in this case, other than just, you know, a screw up, a big screw up? Everyone's mad about the screw up, but like, what can you point to say, like, this tells me there wasn't just a huge screw up in this case, there was actual like malice and malfeasance towards my client?
Apart from the government's lack of transparency, despite professing transparency, I would point to the Deputy Staff Judge Advocate's emails and her communications, where she said that she was not satisfied that the supervisory trial counsel understood the gravity of the situation.
How is that inconsistent with like, hey, you guys really screwed up, and I don't think you're taking it seriously enough?
It could be as small as that, Your Honor, but I think the fact that it gave her enough pause to say, I got to call this guy's supervisor and have a conversation, because there was something that was said in that conversation that gave her pause.
She's just pissed because they left your client in jail for 26 days when he didn't need to be, right?
Well,
I mean, it seems completely reasonable that she'd be upset about this, right? Even if it's just negligence. I just don't see how it's inconsistent with negligence, why it establishes to the extent that we now need additional discovery that there was something more than negligence.
Well, and I think I would point back to Campbell's factors itself, Your Honor. It just, we have to make a colorable showing. We don't have to prove it at this point. We have to make a colorable showing, and then we should be able to get the discovery and have the court review it and decide the extent to which it impacts their analysis. They didn't grant the discovery that we had requested. After that colorable showing of known evidence that was relevant to the issue, and as a result, their analysis of what the relief should be was limited by the facts that they allowed themselves to see, and that's not due process.
Any further questions? You may briefly conclude.
For those reasons, Your Honor, we ask the Court to vacate the lower court's opinion, to remand the case, and order additional fact-finding, specifically the items that we've requested, and additional fact-finding as the Court finds appropriate, and additional sentence reassessment after the appellant has had an opportunity to present additional assignments of errors or supplement his assignments of errors.
The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the Court will stand in recess until 10:35.
All right. Court stands in recess until 10:35.